This podcast is part of the Shareable Podcast Network. Learn more at shareable.fm. This podcast is Shareable. I'm your host, Jeff Gibbard, commonly known as the world's most handsome strategist and professional speaker. I'm also a superhero. Make sure to subscribe so you don't miss a single Shareable episode. And that's it. That's the intro. Short and sweet. Let's get to the show. When relationships are critical to your business, your reputation is one of the most important assets you manage. Today on the podcast, I'm joined by Bill Coletti. He's a highly experienced and sought-after reputation management strategist and speaker. So today, get ready for a deep dive session into the world of corporate crisis management, personal development, communication, reputation, and brand. Those are all the things that I want to talk about today with you, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Jeff, I'm super glad to be here. Excited to have a great conversation.
Yeah, man. I've had a number of guests on over the years who talk about either crisis or communication or brand. And it's a subject that I am endlessly fascinated by and I'm always looking to learn more about. And something that I don't think enough people really take the kind of the crisis side of things seriously. They don't think like, oh, wow, something could just happen out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's worth thinking about, talking about. I want to get into some specifics about that. But just as a starting point, can you give a little bit more color about your background and the sort of work that you're doing on a regular basis just to set the stage for people today?
Yeah, awesome. So started my career running political campaigns. So did politics. My first job was as a senior in high school and then graduated and continued into the fall with a campaign and then kept doing that through college and did that for another dozen or so years. Then went to Europe and ran some campaigns in Europe and did a little bit of politics over there and then came back and finished my last US Senate race in 2000. And then in around 2000, sort of determined that there was a nice inflection point from campaign politics, political campaigns, to corporate campaigns and issues management. And then that then morphed into crisis communications because a lot of organizations, companies found themselves in a challenge. So about 2000 or so transitioned into what I'm doing now. And then in 2013, I founded Kith, the firm that I'm running now. And we've been doing that. And we do three things. We do crisis response. We're firefighters. We come running. We do crisis training, crisis simulation, and we also do professional development for corporate communicators. And then lastly, we also do, we have an online training program for the skill sets, the mindset and behavior of corporate leaders. So those big three things we do.
Rocking. That's a lot of cool stuff to be able to say that you're able to do these days.
Yeah,
I want to talk definitely about communications as like just a big general umbrella. I want to talk a little bit about leadership and personal development and that kind of where all of the work you do kind of touches on leadership, either corporate leadership or leaders inside of companies. Mm-hmm. And I definitely want to talk about the role-playing aspect. That was one thing that kind of perked up. So I went through your book and I really appreciate the way it was laid out. I really appreciate the way that you explain things. And I also appreciate that throughout it, you have a very balanced view on things. That's kind of what I took away from it. So I'm sure you're familiar with Edward Bernays and the whole, propaganda and the whole birth of the public relations industry and kind of all of the, I guess, the seedy underbelly side of that world. Mm-hmm. And then there's kind of the more modern version of some of the icky fuzzy line stuff like sponsored content. And I like that in your book, you really went through virtually all of this stuff. And you went through it in a way that that I felt was very balanced. It wasn't taking a particular position one way or the other. It was kind of explaining it and helping to set the context to help people understand this world. So I just wanted to, first of all, appreciate you for that. And by the way, since I mentioned the book, I might as well give a pitch for it. I just had it right next to me. It's called
Critical Moments.
Critical Moments. That's right.
New mindset of corporate reputation management. It's a blue cover with green text.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it has the triangle on it or the pyramid. Sorry. Okay. Let's get into a variety of different things. Let's start here. Let's talk first about the overlap between a couple different ideas here. So the book is primarily about reputation, kind of what I pulled from it. And I think there's a huge number of things that reputation overlaps with. For one, brand. There's a huge overlap, and you have a whole section of the book that's devoted to that. So let's start there. What is the interaction and the interplay between brand and reputation in a way that people can kind of take away from it and apply in their worlds?
Yeah. So let's just start with a definition. I think that's a great place to start. And so a working thesis that I've sort of evolved originally came from a book a guy named Fombroom wrote years ago, is that a company owns its brand, the public owns your reputation. So a company owns its brand, the public owns its reputation. And what the context is it's a really great debate. And so a brand thinker like you, it's a really, for me as a reputation thinker, it's a great way to sort of use that as a foundation. So a company owns its brand. A company can control all aspects of brand. And if you go back to the 1960s and the marketing mix, when we sort of first developed the four P's of marketing, price, product, place, promotion, companies can control all aspects of that. They can control the price, they can control the features and benefits, they can control any number of things. Companies control that. And so that to me is brand, and that is really fundamentally about a commercial relationship that companies have with individuals. Reputation is, I don't shop at BP gas stations because BP is not convenient for me. Okay. That's just not on my route. When I did go to the office, it's not on my route to and from an office. And I just don't shop at a BP. And so I don't have a commercial relationship, but I have a really strong belief about their reputation and their contribution to society as a company. And more consumers are making brand decisions based on non-economic reputational constructs. And so I believe that I can control the brand. There are lots of levers, and you know this, you're an expert in this, lots of levers that companies can control relative to brand and user experience and what have you. Reputation, I'm trying to offer that there are the same set of disciplines for what is generally perceived to be a softer discipline, the reputation side. And it's really more about the public, not customers or purchasers.
So there's got to be some sort of like a space between it. And so I have a model that's actually kind of similar to this, where I look at brand unity. Like when I think about brand, I think, you know, big B brand, like what is, when it all comes together and it becomes this like aha moment, there are kind of three different pieces to it. There's your intent, what you intend to do. There's your culture and your actions. So the things you actually do. So that's kind of what you're talking about brand. It's what you intend to do and then what you actually do. So those are the levers that you can pull. And then there's the reputation, what people say about you. And I say the spot at which intent and reputation overlap is brand congruence. The spot where reputation and actions meet is meeting expectations. So if you behave a certain way and people have a reputation or belief about you, and you do what you said you're going to do, you're meeting expectation. When you bring all three together, that's where you get that brand unity.
Yeah.
So that's how I tend to think about those things. So I really like the model that you've got here. And I can, in my head, I've always been able to see that there's this overlap between what the brand is trying to accomplish and what people think about it. And there's definitely like a semantic argument about there about like, is that the brand or is that the reputation? Yeah. I think that's an irrelevant argument, and let's just move forward with.
Yeah. It's a Venn diagram. Two circles come together and we can decide how big the middle piece is, or do they just fundamentally overlap? And so I was talking to the guys at Walmart about this, and behemoth brand, huge brand.
Yep.
They've got reputational challenges. There are reputational perceptions of non-consumers about Walmart. How do they pay their people, energy demands, sourcing China, any number of things that people think of Walmart, you know, weird, sleazy stores, whatever the case may be, whatever people think. A lot of those things are not true. But what they've decided is that it is all about the brand. They're going to do reputational things because it's good. They believe, the CEO believes in being a good corporate citizen. But they know that it's a long haul before you and I have a conversation that Walmart is one of the number one solar users in the United States. That's not going to be on the tip of our tongue. We're going to talk about Patagonia, Starbucks, and Tesla long before we're ever going to talk about Walmart. And they get that. So they're just going to drive into the brand. And that's that Venn diagram. And that's just companies being smart. There are some, Patagonia, it's all about the reputation. That, you know, Patagonia, you know, is getting where they're going because they just stand for some amazing things. The brand, the product, they work, they do a fine job, they do a good, but it's really more about what that company stands for. And then somewhere in the middle there is Starbucks and kind of how they, you know, the coffee's not particularly great. It's convenient for a lot of people, but they really seem to be doing a lot of the right things in society. So it's a circle endless. And I love it when I talk to brand marketers. I love the fact that you have the mental agility to sort of see it as a Venn diagram, and we don't have to talk about it as sales and marketing or brand and reputation, you know, or chicken or egg. We can actually think about it in a structured way.
Yeah, so much all of that. And what occurred to me as you were saying all of that is that it seems like there's one brand, but there's potentially numerous reputations that are happening, right? So like the brand is this thing where you're saying, this is our brand. These are the things we're going to do to reinforce this brand. These are the ways we're going to message that brand. But no matter what you do, you could say like, we believe, like you could say Black Lives Matter, right? Like that could be your statement that you put out, and all of the brand things that you do show that like, that's what you believe. Like Patagonia's got like very environmentally friendly, right?
Sure.
But some people could see that statement and go, ah, corporate pandering. And your reputation to that group of people is, I don't believe that, I don't buy that, whatever. Where somebody else might go, oh, that's exactly what I'm looking for. I believe in those things. Your reputation is sound with me, right? So the brand actions are the same thing, but the reputations that come from it are so potentially different. So like you bring up Walmart, there's a company that's going to have reputations across the board, depending upon where you are, small markets, big markets, international markets,
suppliers, supply chain. Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. So that's such an interesting thing. I'm curious then, going from that, from the brand to reputation conversation, thinking about that Venn diagram, how does one alter reputation without focusing on brand? How do you go about it? Because it sounds to me as somebody who works in brand, that's a brand challenge, right? Like you have to get that brand to reach those people and influence their reputation. But you have an entire book where you go through a whole thing talking that the whole book really talks about the process of building reputation. That's not the same as building brand. So where did those two roads diverge then? We've got the overlapping Venn diagram. Separate them for us so we can see what is reputation work.
Yeah, it's about the outcome and why as a corporation are we taking these actions? Okay, so from a brand context, we are going to improve our online shopping cart experience. We're going to improve the experience that we have online. We're going to make our website slick and easy, and we're going to have a really smart back-end e-commerce platform. Those are brand decisions that make it easier for me to leave reviews, easier for me to do whatever needs to be done in that context. My expectation and the reason why strategists like you advise make these changes is to grow the shopping cart, increase sales. And so that's the reason we're doing it. The expectation of why we go on a reputation journey and why we do reputation is not unrelated to economic growth and purchases, but it's not rooted in that. That decision about the website is rooted in more sales. I believe, particularly in B2B, but also in B2C, that reputation, you get three main things from a growing reputation. So the answer to your question is, how do you make that distinction? It's based on what's your expectation, what's the outcome that you want. Having a strong brand, particularly in a B2B context, against to a certain extent B2C, is all things being equal, price and product, everything being the same, the company with the stronger reputation, strong reputation breaks ties. So if you've got a choice on price, if price is the same, supply is the same, companies with strong reputation win. Crises are inevitable. Problems happen. There are chinks in the armor. There's sexual harassment. There's data breach. There's any number of things. Companies with strong reputation get the benefit of the doubt. And Jeff, you and I talk about it and you say, wow, that's not the company X I know. Yeah. I have a different belief of them. And so we give them the benefit of the doubt if they screw up on their taxes or have a data breach or any number of these other things that are out there. You know, and then the third thing is that strong reputation companies have a license to operate. And so Chick-fil-A is a great American success story, Southern roots. They have very strong beliefs about LGBTQ issues. They're relatively conservative. The Truitt family is a relatively conservative family. Their license to operate, their ability to open stores in San Francisco and New York and Boston were slowed because of what they believe in Atlanta. And so you could argue that's a bad thing, good thing, whatever. But to the third point, a strong reputation enhances your license to operate. And the Chick-fil-A example is the best example of how that works out. So you get those three things of why investing in reputation as a side or as an adjacency to brand is those three really critical things. That's why you invest in reputation.
I love it because the way that I tend to think about brand is like, so I come from a, integrated marketing background. So I did a lot of digital marketing for about a decade. And what I really was interested in the whole time at, you know, when I really thought about it was I was interested in the brand underneath. And I was interested in the brand underneath, not because I cared about so much, even the marketing and sales. So as somebody who works in brand, as a brand strategist, I'm not even what I would call a brand marketer. I'm about like the soul of the brand. Like, why do you exist in this world? What is the change you're trying to make? And I think that kind of to your point, like there's benefits that come down the line, but it's not the primary focus, right? Mm-hmm. So when we talk about reputation in this way, I'm like, this is hitting on all cylinders for me because I think there are bigger things than whether or not you're able to drive revenue. Now, we always have to think about that. We have to tie it back to that. But I appreciate the way that you're kind of laying this out. Now, I want to touch on the crisis part now, because I think that's an interesting thing to bring into this mix, because there's, I think a lot of people, when they hear the word, the term reputation management, the first thing they actually think about is crisis management. Somebody screwed up. I got some bad Google reviews, results. I need you to suppress them by putting out a bunch of like, you know, fake nonsense, right? Yeah. So let's dispel that myth right now, because I know that your version of what you mean by reputation management is an entirely different thing. And I think we need to put that version of reputation management to bed because it's phony, it's false, it's inauthentic, and it's doing real harm to, I think, the brands that want to focus on their reputation in a meaningful way. So let's reframe that. Yeah. What does reputation management actually mean? And so, where does it overlap with crisis communication?
So what I tried to do in the book is, and I'll tell you, if you don't mind, I'll just tell you a little bit of a quick story about this. So I'm with a female CEO. She's an amazing leader. We had gone through 5 days of New York Times evisceration. We finally made it through the backside. And she said, well, that sucked. Let's never do that again. And so it was a crisis of their own making, and we managed through the situation. And through that journey, I kept talking about, well, what you need is a reputation management program. You need reputation management. When the New York Times is crawling over every bit of your company, that's really not the time to talk as a consultant to talk about this pie in the sky reputation management stuff. You got to stop the bleeding. It's kind of like talking about diet and exercise when you're having a heart attack. The patient typically doesn't listen when you're doing that. And so the crisis was over. We were debriefing. I was getting ready to head back to home. And she said, so tell me about this reputation thing, because I've heard what you've been saying and I'm interested in what that is. And what she wanted is she wanted a model like what she knew from MBA school around the four P's, which we all learned 100 years ago, and we can argue whether it's applicable in a digital age, the four P's: price, product, place, promotion. I talked about it a minute ago. She said, I need a model that explains what you mean by reputation in the same way. So what I did is I articulated this four A's, and it's the model that we talk about in the book, in those four A's. And the point of all of that is that reputation used to be considered this sort of, I'm just going to do good things. I'm going to treat my people well. I'm going to write a check to the United Way. And I'm not going to talk about Black Lives Matter. I'm not going to talk about guns, or I'm not going to talk about these social issues, because that's not really my lane. I sell lumber. That's not my thing. What I tried to offer is that just like the same way you manage inventory, the same way you manage legal, the same way you manage HR, the same way you manage brand, there's a model, a system that you can have KPIs against and budget. And that's what I shared with her. And she was the genesis of why I came up with the four A's. And so the model lets us stop talking about it in the abstract, but actually talk about fundable, budgetable. You can assign a vice president of X, because if you think back to the four P's, that was the innovation of the four P's. As a CEO, you could assign a vice president of price, vice president of place, vice president of promotion, and you could manage all of those things of marketing. Now we've gotten a lot more sophisticated. That's what I tried to create, so that it can be managed as opposed to cross your fingers, let's write a check to the United Way and hope people like us. It is a manageable asset. And so that's what I tried to offer as the means to do that, all with the mind's eye of a hedge against the inevitability of a crisis. That's why we're doing it. We're doing it, A, because it's the right thing to do fundamentally, but B, we are doing it as an insurance policy hedge against bad things happen, which inevitably do. So that's why we invest. And she forced me to think about this model, because she said, I want a 4P like model. So that's why I came up with the four A's.
I would have met, I like your heart attack example, because it immediately made me think of this reputation management as being like the good diet and exercise, right? It's the idea that if you do this work when crisis inevitably strikes, to your point before, the companies with a good reputation get the benefit of the doubt. And on top of that, you've probably also set yourself up so when this thing happens, you have the steps in place, because that's part of a reputation management playbook, right? Is to be ready for when something goes wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's unpack that even further. So taking the diet and exercise. So I'm a 50-year-old man. I've got a family of heart, I've got a history of heart disease in my family. I go to my doctor and my doctor is going to say, okay, Bill, you need to diet and exercise. And we can argue which one's more important. You know, diet probably a little bit more important. You're not going to exercise your way to health, but you got to do both of those. Or I could give you a pill, give you a statin, and you know, everything will just sort of be okay. But you'll still be fat and have a high heart rate. Okay. I'd rather you did diet and exercise. We can do the same thing with corporations. Okay. And it's two aspects of it. One aspect is crisis readiness. Are our systems in place? Are our team, is our team ready? We talked about media training early in before the call. Is our CEO media trained? Do we have talking points? Do we have crisis plans? So there's this whole arc, which is like diet, of crisis readiness. Underneath it is, I think, the next frontier for reputation is this understanding around risk. You know, risk primarily within American corporations has been one of two things. It's been the people that buy insurance. Okay, I have a warehouse that could catch on fire. I'm going to buy insurance. That's a risk. Or people that are doing risk intelligence. They're looking at trade risk, monetary risk, you know, geopolitical risk, whatever the case may be. I believe that there is a way that we can understand our risks, because all crises come from risk. And so that's the diet, crisis readiness, make sure my team is exercised and ready. And then the exercise component is this, what we call risk acuity, or understanding of your risk, so that you can actually begin to mitigate the crappy things that are going to happen, and actually pre-think about race in America, George Floyd, pre-think issues about politics. Are we going to weigh in Georgia? Things like that. So that's why we think it's diet, exercise, crisis readiness, along with this notion of risk acuity, understanding the risks that can hurt you.
Can we talk, I don't know if you want to go, I don't know how deep you want to go on this. I'm sure you can talk at a high level about it, but you pointed out three different types of risk. And I thought that that was, I'm a huge fan of frameworks, by the way. So like anytime,
I
see a book and you've got frameworks, like I just store them away.
Oh, aren't they great? They're wonderful amazing mental models. We could talking about, you know, frameworks and the power of frameworks.
Frameworks and mental models. Like we could do a whole episode on that, but you've got these three different types of risk in here. Yeah. And as soon as I saw them, I was like, oh my God, that's such an interesting way to think about risk. So can you talk about those three, the strategic, preventable, the external?
Yep, absolutely. High level. So fundamentally three types of risk, and there's an emerging fourth, which is something that we should probably talk about. Ooh. But fundamentally three risks: strategic risk, preventable risk, and external risk. And this all comes from the reforms from 2008 in the financial services industry. A lot of reform as we were thinking about risk. So these, I've extrapolated them into a reputation communication context from the financial industry. So strategic. I meant to raise the prices. I meant to close the factory. I meant to use red dye number 5. A strategic risk is a risk that a company takes on because they believe that it will achieve superior economic return. So I meant to do something, okay? I meant to do this thing. Preventable risks are things you should have zero tolerance for. The easiest example of that is there should never be metal shavings in hamburger patties, okay? And so if we had Bill and Jeff's hamburger company and we were pumping out patties, there should not be metal shavings. That is a preventable risk. With technology and magnets and radar or whatever the case, we can prevent that. And that should never, ever happen. The same could probably be said for salmonella and E. coli and other things that come in, that, you know, bad things. But there are preventable risks that you undertake that have no economic value to the organization. External are force majeure, whether if you are Home Depot in Miami-Dade, a hurricane is going to hit you. You are going to get hit by a hurricane. And so that is an external risk. And then active shooter, some crazy person comes on campus and does something horrific. That's an external risk. You cannot wall off your community to a certain extent, or to that extent. So strategic, I meant to do it for economic benefit. Preventable means I should zero tolerance. It should never happen. And external, outside of my control. The challenge is that communicators go to their operational colleagues within corporations and say, hey, Jeff, Mr. Operations, tell me what's going to hurt us. Tell me what could blow up. Tell me what could go wrong. And the operations folks are like, that is the dumbest, naive question I've ever heard. I'm not going to tell, because there's all kinds of things that could happen. If communicators come with this framework, this architecture, what are the things that we're doing that we mean to do that you think people might not understand? Great conversation.
Yep.
What are the things that have happened? We just are like, oh crap, we've got to fix it. Preventable. What are the things outside of our control? So it gives communicators a framework to talk to their operational colleagues in a really, really smart way, as opposed to blank sheet of paper, Chicken Little.
I would, correct me if I'm wrong here, or if my instincts are right here, I guess. I look at these three and I think preventable risk and external risk. External risk probably being the easiest to be forgiven for. Like nobody's going to fault you for hurricane hitting your building, right? Like maybe you could have taken more precautions, but it seems like that's the one where you're going to get the most of a pass, right? Mm-hmm. Preventable risk are things where it's like accidents do happen, but as long as you took every precaution, you know, like Southwest, they're, you know, they had an engine that blew at mm-hmm. some point, right? Like mm-hmm. nobody said like, oh, Southwest, it's that Southwest company that's always blown. It's like, it happens. They obviously tried to do, you know, mm-hmm. the right thing after the fact. Maybe they didn't do enough maintenance, but okay. Mm-hmm. I feel like the strategic risk is the one where the real, the tussle has to happen, right? Like you really got to work through some stuff. Cause the first thing that I thought of when you said like, oh, here's the things that we're meaningfully doing. Like we decided to do it for economic benefit. Those are the ones where it's like, oh, well, what if that economic benefit comes to harm other human beings, right? Mm-hmm. Now there's reputational mm-hmm. risk in that strategic risk more so than in the other one. So is my instinct right there? That's where the real big work needs to be done from a reputational standpoint.
Yes, 90%. There's just a little bit of sprinkle I'd like to put on preventable.
Ooh, sprinkle it.
Yeah, is that? And I want to stick with the thread of what you said because it's really super smart. Is on the preventable side, the thing that this model does is it allows organizations to pre-think their response. A preventable risk, just use metal shavings and hamburgers. The immediate response is, that was a mistake, we're going to fix it, and here's a $10 off coupon. And just don't apologize, and you apologize, and you just get back to business as fast as you can. While yes, strategic is the really gnarly stuff that I want to talk to you about, there are still companies, when they get called out on preventable risks, still are afraid to apologize and still deny it and still fumble fart around and screw it up. So you're right. Your instincts are right on. Strategic's where it's at. There are still some laggards in American corporate world that screw up what you and I think are relatively straightforward. The way you explained it was perfect. The way we think about it, because there are still those laggards. So 10%, not 100% just yet.
Got it.
But strategic is right on. You're absolutely right. That's where the issue is. And I've got a lot of thoughts on how we can fix that.
Got it. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about that. And I want to touch on something that you said earlier that it's another one of those phrases that when people hear it, there's a certain reaction to it, I think. Mm-hmm. So you had mentioned being ready with our talking points. Mm-hmm. And talking points is one of those phrases that I think people immediately will begin to feel like, oh, well, it's inauthentic, it's BS, mm-hmm. it's mm-hmm. this and that and the other thing. And I've been in this world long enough to know that that's not always the case. I also know that it is the case sometimes. Sure. You have your talking points to try to throw journalists off the scent, mm-hmm. right? But other times the talking points is really just about being prepared and understanding how in a high stakes situation, you say what it is that you actually mean rather than something stupid. Mm-hmm. So as we're talking about how companies can go about managing strategic risk and some of the role-playing scenarios, if you could, can you touch a little bit on
great
talking points and the importance of that and what that actually means in your way of doing things?
Absolutely. So this is the perfect domain of strategic risk and thinking about strategic risk. So let's agree on the hypothetical just for the sake of our conversation. we are going to close a major manufacturing facility at Jeff and Bill Incorporated. All right. So we're going to lay off 1,000 employees, and it's a big deal. The economic, that product line we're getting rid of, whatever the case may be. Okay. And so that's going to crush the little community that it's in. And it's a really big deal. All right. So we can just go do that, as a matter of fact, shut it down, or we can be ready with talking points that says, well, we've negotiated an exit package with our union. We're doing job reskill training for our employees. We're writing an economic development grant to the Smallville community that's there. And we're working with the governor to potentially open up a new facility next year. Okay. Those are talking points. Those are four things that we're going to do, as opposed to shut her down. And the media calls and says, well, why did you shut her down? Everybody then scurries around with chickens with their head cut off, trying to figure out, well, why did we shut it down? If we think about it and we're smart about it and communication is involved, predicting some of the things that are inevitably going to happen, that's where talking points come in. There's no spin there. We are going to do all those things. We did talk to the union. We are going to negotiate retraining for people. We are going to do a grant to the community. We're going to buy a swimming pool or whatever we're going to do in the community. And that's just one of many examples of strategic risk. It could be that we're going to introduce a product or take away a product. You know, those are all strategic challenges. And there are legacy, I'm sure there are legacy technologies that you love that you get pissed when they go away.
But constantly.
The company decided to take it away. So that shouldn't come as a surprise. Someone should put points that can be said, hence talking points, and that's not spin. We're not lying. Yes, we are taking away that product. Here's why we're doing it. And so just to continue with this rant a little bit, is that what happens too often is that companies, when they don't think about risk in this framework, companies undertake a strategic risk for superior economic benefit, some sort of gain. And when someone calls them out on it, they go, oh, well, we didn't mean to do that. And that's just BS. Of course you meant to do it. You need to do a better job of explaining why you did it, hence vis-a-vis talking points, explain why you did it, as opposed to like, oh my gosh, we're closing that factory. I didn't know that. And that's just disingenuous and crappy. That's why communications, guys like you and me, need to be in those operational manufacturing or product decisions, because they impact, and therefore we can be ready with these magical talking points that we're talking about. And talking points are nothing more. I would assume before you talked to me, you wrote a few notes down.
Yeah,
I don't think you did that because you want to spin me. I think you did that because you wanted to be prepared to have a logical conversation that kept people interested. That's all talking points are.
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense. And yes, I did. I love to do my preparation for my guests that I've come in, because this podcast is my gift to myself to get to talk to interesting, smart people and learn from them. And then I share it with you, audience. I hope you're enjoying it. So it sounds obvious what I'm about to say, but for some reason, despite it being so obvious, it seems like it almost seems like quaint and naive, but it seems that honesty and transparency is really important in doing this work correctly, right? That like you can only get so far on spin and BS instead of just saying what's actually true. You know, at least when you say what is true, then people know that they can believe, even if you just say something ugly, like that we had to do this, I'm sorry, and we know people are harmed by it. At least they're like, wow, well, at least they're being honest about the situation. And I just wish that there was some way that became more the norm than what our expectations tend to be about the entire public relations industry, the entire reputation management industry, the entire brand industry, is we are conditioned to believe everyone is trying to sell us something and they are trying to lie to us to get us to buy more stuff or whatever, instead of the model that I feel like is being very clearly articulated here of being thoughtful about what it is we're trying to do and communicating it to people so that we can continue to operate in the ways that is authentic to who we are. So do me a favor, and I want to go back to the four A's real quick. Can you just quickly explain what those four A's are, and you know where the different parts that we've talked about so far kind of fit into that? Obviously, I don't want you to go. You wrote a whole book that's fantastic. Really, like, I don't want you to give that away.
Start on chapter one.
Yeah, it's literally on the cover. So if you could just kind of give like a high level so people kind of understand what the process looks like at a high level. And then from there, I want to move on to talking a little bit about influencers to kind of wrap us up.
Yeah, that's cool. And then if we get a second, I'd love to come back and talk to you about, you know, what you're, the point you just made about authenticity and transparency. And why.
Actually, if you want to start there, let's do that.
Yeah. So I think in the continuum, and then happy to talk about the four A's, you know, we're all human, man. And companies are run by humans. And I remember as a middle schooler getting a bad report card, I wasn't really authentic and transparent with mommy and daddy. All right. So we're trained really early to be inauthentic. And I, for my wife, I forgot something and I fumbled around and tried to make it up an excuse because I'm a human. And so we bring those traits into our governance and management decision-making. And it's hard. Telling the truth is sadly hard sometimes. And add then to the complexity that there is this old saw or legacy belief that, well, if I apologize in a crisis, or if I do own up to things, I'm going to get sued. The reality is you're going to get sued anyways. So I would rather be the guy that gets sued that apologized, or the guy that didn't apologize. So, yeah. So there's truth. So we're humans. I struggled as a middle schooler, struggle as a husband to sometimes be super authentic, and it's only natural. But a lot of companies are realizing that the beautiful way you just said that, realize the epiphany of it ain't that hard. Just here's what happened. We didn't mean to do it. Hopefully the company's thought about it. That's the important part, is they are thoughtful. That's why a risk framework, that the strategic, preventable, external, is so important.
Well, just to that point, it's a good example you used about like kind of framing it in very real terms, right? Your mm-hmm. family, you're married, you've got kids, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as individuals, maybe we are obviously human, we're flawed. We may not want to come clean on something, but in the same context, if we think about the family unit, the family structure that you kind of laid out there, we have certain values that we as a family abide by. One of them's probably going to be honesty, right? Like you expect honesty from your kids, you expect honesty from your partner. So the values of the family. So, you know, taking this out of the individual and into the company now, I think this actually explains why brand work, reputation work is so vital, is because what you're doing is you're setting the context of how do we operate as a, I hate to use the word family here because the whole company family thing is like a muddy water. But if we think of our organization as a structure that has certain aligned upon values, if we make one of those values, honesty and transparency, now we know in those situations, even though our human instinct might be, we shouldn't apologize for this, we shouldn't, whatever. If you set out from the outset to say, here's the type of reputation we want, here's the type of brand we want to be. I think that right there crystallized a really, really nice example about, you know, the difference between making decisions as like a unilateral CEO, here's how we're going to do it, versus here's how we as an organization are being guided, and then kind of looking to our leaders to be able to carry that vision through.
Yeah. And you said, and early on you said, and you somewhat said it here, your great work, the work that you do is about the core level DNA about why do companies exist? Why does Pete's Hardware Store exist? What, Pete, what are you really trying to do? What is the, at the core of that, or software company or whatever that's there? And that's important and it's critical. And it shades so many other subsequent decisions. And that's probably why you evangelize it, because if you get that part right, it makes everything else relatively straightforward. The same goes in crisis response. The key distinction between crisis response is speed, okay? Filling the vacuum of information with your side of the story, the truth, your truth, is the key differentiator between good and great crisis response is speed. Speed is an equation. Speed comes from mission and values plus chain of command. If Pete doesn't know what he stands for, there is no way that he can be fast in a crisis, because they're trying to figure out what they stand for. Yeah. And if they haven't figured out their chain of command, who makes decisions, who's in the room, who's not in the room, what voices have more weight than other voices, you'll never be fast. So you're right on with this notion that if you get your reason for being, you are so much better at just about everything else at the company, but you're just that much better at crisis response because you know what you stand for. And it makes the questions easier to answer. So we got off on a little sidebar there, but I think that's a really critical concept.
Yeah, I completely agree. Completely agree. So yeah. So two things.
Do the four A's.
Yeah. So let's do the four A's. I have so many things I want to talk to you about, but I realize like we're running tight on time, but I have four or five other things that I was like, oh, I should totally ask Bill about this. But so if you could quickly go over the four A's so people understand Sure. Kind of like what's the process, and we'll see what we have time for, but we'll see what we get to next.
Yeah. So four A's, really simple. There's four A's, five features. So if you've got the cover of the book, you can sort of see the book. First one is awareness. All right. Is that I need to be aware of myself as a company. Goes back to what you and I just talked about. What's our reason for being? What do we stand for? What is the root concepts of who we are? What's our marketplace? Who do we serve? There's just this basic notion of self-awareness, self-diagnosis, self-questioning. So that's the foundational element of that. Who are we and what do we stand for? That's the awareness component. Assessment. Once you have awareness, assessment is to go ask people, ask your employees, ask your stakeholders, do some good old fashioned survey research, or just questioning, you know, just call your top five customers and assess where you are. Once you do that, it goes to authority. So we want to go on a reputation journey. We need to make sure that we know who we are. We need to see what our marketplace really wants. We then need to go talk to leadership and say, here's what we want to do. Can we actually not just talk this talk, but walk this walk? Can we really do the things that people are expecting us? Because there are plenty of CEOs and general counsels, to our previous point, that never want to apologize. There are plenty of general counsels and CEOs that don't want to lean in on Black Lives Matter because it's not our lane. And so authority is critically important. There's then in the a feature of the triangle, there's a blue line, and that's a membrane between the final A, which is action. That blue membrane or blue line that's there is to protect companies from guys like you and me that want to jump everybody to action. Well, let's do this. Let's write a check to the United Way. Let's lean on LGBTQ. Let's change our logo for Gay Pride Month. Let's do all of these things, jumping to action immediately. So there's this blue line that says, stop. Are we aware? Have we assessed? Do we have the authority to do this? Then we can jump to action. And so that's the fourth A, is action. And that's where what I call leadership marketing. That's where leadership marketing comes from, and the ability to actually do something. So a feature that gets lost in the four A's is what I say is sort of the consultant filter to keep people from sharing too many good ideas and doing stupid things.
Fair, totally fair points, all fair points. Let me ask you this, within that model, who are we talking about here? Are we talking about the C-suite? Are we talking about VP level and up? Or is this for everyone when you go through role-playing scenarios through these things? Is this for everyone? Like how deep do you recommend most companies go? And I'd imagine it depends on time and budget and size of the company.
But it has to be the C-suite. I mean, that's why that authority feature is so important. It has to go to the top levels of the organization. I've seen so many inspirational marketers, brand leaders, CMOs, category leaders, that their ideas just fall flat because the leadership won't go with them. And so it has to be the tippy top of the organization, the senior leadership. I would argue for some of our clients, it has to be at the board. I mean, the board has to be bought into this, because some of this is, if you're an economically driven board of directors, you're like, what the heck are we doing? Why are we doing that? We need to be just cranking out more widgets and not wasting our time doing this. Hopefully those folks are aging out, but I know they exist. So no, I think it's as high in the organization as possible. I then think it's more about evangelism down in your organization and listening ultimately once you do it. But I think leadership, you're leaders for a reason, and you got the leadership, the top of the organization has to set the course.
Got it, man. Awesome. So I don't have time. I don't think we have time to go too deeply into both of the things that I have left. So I'm going to give you the choose your own adventure of where we close out this episode. Okay.
Yeah.
So one, we could talk about role-playing situations and going through some basic examples of how you would recommend companies kind of role-play for and think about potential crisis. I recommend, I have a book coming out in January called The Lovable Leader, and I recommend leadership role-play, where essentially you put people in scenarios and you give people the opportunity to step into the leadership role in that situation.
Awesome.
And you put them through it in a test environment. And then when a live environment happens, you bring them in and give them the opportunity to lead as well. Like you need to have hands-on experience in leadership, especially under high stakes, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'd imagine in what you're doing, there's a lot of very, very similar ideas. So one, we can go down, you know, role-playing and maybe one or two quick examples of like how that might go. That's one. The other is unobvious influencers, which I thought was just such an interesting idea and wanted to, you know, you have so much in there about influencer marketing. And I love the way you do it because it's not the BS influencer marketing of like, oh, well, we'll get Kendall Jenner to talk about why our software company isn't actually racist. You know, like, you know what I'm saying? Like it's actual, you're talking about like real life people who are passionate about a thing and are interested in more than just the payout for it. So choose your own adventure. Which of these two do you think is a better? Because I'm totally down to have you come back and talk about more stuff whenever you feel like it. But I'll give you the chance. Which one?
Yeah, let's do the simulation stuff. I think it's more thematic to what we've been talking about the reputation and context. I think unobvious influencers is a tactic that fits underneath that. And if it lets me come back and have another chat with you, let's leave it hanging for that. So we can do simulations and readiness context.
Got it. So I'll set it up for you. I have often recommended to companies that they do more role-playing in general, role-play sales conversations, role-play customer interviews, role-play all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. Crisis is one of those things where I think the first thing that happens is it's sort of like when your wife says, what do you want to have for dinner? You're like, I don't know, what do you want to have for dinner? It's this moment of just complete paralysis of like, well, you kind of explained this back when we were talking about risk, like what could go wrong? It's like, well, literally anything could go wrong. So in terms of like your standard service-based company, let's say, small, medium-sized service-based company, you work with clients, B2B, let's say, where might you start when you start thinking about potential crises you might have to deal with? Yeah. Like, how do you go about sourcing ideas maybe? How do you go about putting together role plays? Take us through a little bit of the journey.
So the best and simplest advice, so we sell crisis simulations. And so we've got a number of big Fortune 50 clients, and we do full, robust, two-thirds day crisis simulations where we've got hair on fire, reporters calling, media interviews, CEOs, protests, all kinds of stuff. So we simulate all that stuff for clients, all with the point of identifying gaps in their readiness. So we do that. Everybody doesn't need to do that. The simple thing people need to do, whether the folks listening to this podcast, whether you're a big company, small company, grab the New York Times, the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, your local paper, grab a headline and said, what if that had happened to us? What would we do? That's a simulation. So at a staff meeting, your quarterly, annual, weekly, whatever, grab a copy of the New York Times and say, well, what if that had happened to us? And you go around the room and ask the leadership team, what would we do in response to this? And, oh, I have no idea. We've never really thought of that. That's a good gap that probably should be solved. So simulations are nothing more than taking experiential moments in the world and applying them to you. And so that's what we do in these simulations. It does a lot of things. One is you really learn on your team who's ready and who's up for the game, because the crucible of crisis doesn't develop your skill set, it reveals it. And so I really believe in crisis. People know they're either in it or don't, or should not be in it. And so that's what simulations gets you. And it is a great way. To your question around risk, what are the particular risks? That's a bigger exercise where I think communications, marketing, and operations need to have a conversation about strategic, preventable, and external. You can talk about specific risks that we know could happen in our company. We can talk about specific risks that happen in our industry. And then we can talk about these societal risks that are impacting every corporation. We've got a process that we walk our clients through. It's a pretty straightforward process and really can be done on your own. It does not start with a blank sheet of paper. It starts with, you know, Martians landing at my headquarters should not be on my list. There are known risks and we all should understand and know those risks. So a little bit of interviewing, a little bit of understanding. But the simple thing, Jeff, is at a staff meeting, say the leader to say, what if this had happened to us? And just watch what happens. That's a simulation. That's the best thing that a company can do.
That is such a profoundly good idea that is so simple and straightforward. Mm-hmm. I'm like glowing with excitement about how good that is. And I hope that everyone listening really does go and take that one. Cause that costs you like nothing. It costs you a newspaper and you can literally go through the exercise. That is so brilliant. I often, back when I was more heavily into marketing, we would, when we were doing content calendars, we would be coming up with ideas, and we would have like our different content lanes that we would be in. And I would bring in a stack of like 25 magazines, and I'd be like, see all these headlines? Make one about us. Mm-hmm. And you've got your topics. Let's go. What else do we do? Right. Mm-hmm. And that was always really, really useful. Went really well. You would see like really like, you know, finance, accounting type people who are not used to being in marketing conversations get really excited because you've given them like this nifty tool to be able to work into.
It's a model, Jeff. You just gave a model. That's all that is. It's a model. It's a framework.
I love it. I love it. Well, Bill, you are freaking awesome. You've been a phenomenal guest. I'm really, really excited. I got the chance to talk to you. We covered a lot of interesting ground here. Take this time in the show just to let people know where they can go and be social with you, where they can learn about you, where they can hire you, where they can download stuff, where they can get your book, anything. That this is your chance to shamelessly self-promote. Go ahead.
Cool. Well, thank you very much. This is an awesome, awesome conversation. Company's name is Kith, K-I-T-H. Our website's kith.co. A little old-fashioned, but our website serves us well. So kith.co, you can always find us there. I'm pretty active on LinkedIn and Twitter, and it's just B-C-O-L-E-T-T-I. LinkedIn is Bill Coletti. I think I'm the only one. Real easy. Those are the three platforms to find us best. We've got tons of downloadable stuff. A lot of these ideas I try to write about in our blog. Love to be generous and share cool stuff. You can download tools. We try to give away as much as we can. So Twitter, B Coletti, LinkedIn, Bill Coletti, hit me up there. Love to connect with you. And then if you just want to have a conversation, I just love talking about this stuff and see if it's a fit. We've had enough success that we don't need to convert every conversation into a client. We can just try to be helpful, which is nice.
Dude, that's awesome. You clearly are passionate about the subject. You clearly know what you're talking about. The book is great. I've had the opportunity to read a number of different books on crisis communication, and I put this one in the absolute upper echelon. As I said, I'm a huge fan of frameworks, as we've covered, and I think the book is so practical and useful. Mm-hmm. And I think this conversation just went in so many good directions. We covered so much stuff. It's the sort of conversation people should tell others about. They should tell their friends about it. They should tell their colleagues. They should tell their boss about it. And if they tell people that, I guess it means that they're sharing it, which would make this show shareable.
Wait, don't leave. If you've never listened to my fancy outro, do it just once for me, please. Okay, if you enjoy Shareable and you find it valuable, there's a few ways that you can support the show. One, you can share it on social media, which I strongly encourage. I mean, it's literally the name of the show, Shareable. Two, you can review it on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're an Overcast user, as many of my listeners are, make sure to click that star button on the episodes that you like. The third way that you can support the show is by blogging about it or discussing it on your own podcast or even by making a YouTube video where you talk about one of the episodes. And then the final way that you can support the show is by supporting it directly on Patreon. You can find the link in the show notes. Now, before I let you go, I want to tell you about one other thing. You see, Shareable is just one of many projects that I'm working on at any given time. I've got another podcast called Rogue. I do a live streaming show every week called The Heroic Council. I've got a blog where I release a blog post twice a week. And if you're looking to keep up with all sorts of different content that can help you grow and become a superhero in life, I want you to check out jeffgibber.me. That's where I list all of my current projects and projects that are coming up in the future, including my forthcoming book, The Lovable Leader. It would mean a lot to me if you could go and check out some of the other things I've worked on, because I put just as much of my heart into those projects as I do into Shareable. Thank you so much for being a listener. Thank you for being a supporter, and I hope to see you here on the next episode of Shareable.